and resurrectionists began to think of more ingenious ways of getting hold of fresh, dead human flesh, and examining how it was that 3 years after the Burke and Hare killings for dissection in Edinburgh, murder for dissection arrived here in the capital with the case of the Italian boy. I'm going to be talking in fairly graphic detail about resurrection and the goings-on in London graveyards, so I apologise in advance if that makes any of you feel a little bit queasy. And then at the end, I'll be happy to try and answer any questions that you might have. So to start off, we do actually need to go back as far as the Tudors. In 1540, Henry VIII granted the company of barbers and surgeons, as they were then, the right to the bodies of 4 executed murderers each year to anatomise. Charles II granted the surgeons a further 2 murderers' corpses per year. And in 1752, the law was changed so that any person executed for the crime of murder would suffer the additional penalty of having their body handed over to the surgeons for dissection. The idea was that murder, being obviously the worst crime, should have that extra level of punishment that dissection represented. So from 1752 onwards, murderers would go to the gallows in the knowledge that they would later be taken apart by anatomists in front of, you know, quite a number of anatomist students. Now, Hanoverian Britain was a hangman's paradise, but most people who were being put to death were being put to death for property crimes, and so their corpses weren't claimable by the surgeons. And the expanding medical profession was unable to make do with the national average of around about 10 to 12 people a year who were being executed for murder. And so medical students, along with their teachers, were resorting to disinterring recently buried bodies, though often with the help of labouring men who were becoming increasingly expert at fast, surreptitious exhumation. And by 1800, there are estimated to have been just a few specialist resurrection men operating in London, but the following 20 years saw a vast expansion of medical teaching and a resulting in expansion in the resurrection community. And by the mid-1820s, estimates, and these estimates do vary really wildly, it has to be said, put the requirement for corpses for medical teaching in London alone at between 500 and 1,000. And it's believed that on average, the resurrection men were managing to supply around 500 to 550 corpses a year by one means or another. So we've got here a slightly humorous, taking the edge off the ghastliness, illustration by Phiz, Dickens's one-time illustrator, also known as Hablo K. Brown. And he's kind of lightened the mood a little bit, having the chap sort of swigging away there. But the next one, this is Thomas Rowlandson, much more savage impression of the days of resurrection. This one dates from 1775, and you've got the figure of death here, holding the dark lanthorn over these really unsavoury characters who were in the process of, they're sucking up the body, but Rowlandson's made a bit of a mistake here, a factual mistake, and I think it's fair to say that he probably didn't sketch this from life, precisely because the body belonged to no one except to its former user, and perhaps also to God, if you were so minded. Stealing a corpse wasn't a felony. In law, it was only a misdemeanour, which was seen as really, you know, not quite right by the general populace, that it should be just a misdemeanour. And therefore, it carried a relatively light jail sentence, or sometimes even just a small fine. And the misdemeanour was the unlawful procurement and receiving of a body, or possession of a body with knowledge of illegal disinterment. And in Scotland, they gave it a much more colourful name, the violation of a sepulchre. However, should any item be removed as well as the body, any keepsakes, for instance, or the shroud, or the grave cap, or the lead fittings of a coffin, or the coffin lid, now that was a felony, and a long custodial sentence, or even transportation, could be handed down to those found guilty. So Rowlandson hasn't been quite accurate here, because we can quite clearly see they're trying to make off with the grave clothes as well. This next one is another Moonlight Graveyard scene, a satire. I don't know if you can read the writing at the bottom. I say, Bill, have you heard about the March of the Intellect? They say that everybody will sell themselves. March of the Intellect, we're all getting horribly sophisticated and clever and bright, and our industrialised society is sorting absolutely everything out. Then there's going to come a time where people are going to willingly donate their bodies for science. And of course, they're really worried, you know, it's a joke, but they're worried that such generosity and social progress is going to put them out of business. And then this is my actual favourite picture of resurrection in action. It's not contemporary, actually. It dates from 1913, so long after you would have seen such a sight. But I think more than any other image, it really captures the atmosphere of the deed. I don't know if you can make out here. There's some stars twinkling up here, and there's some lovely rock architecture. And he appears to be in consecrated ground. And I love these horribly overdeveloped muscular forearms. I find them very, very unsettling. But there you go again. The artist has made the mistake of allowing him to commit a felony, not a misdemeanor, by stealing the shroud. We get a great contemporary idea of what a resurrectionist really looked like, a picture in words, from an article in All the Year Round magazine, written by a reporter who happened to be in the corridors of Parliament at the time that the Select Committee on Anatomy was taking evidence. And among the witnesses were a number of resurrection men. And the reporter recalled, for several days in the summer of 1828, a certain committee room of the House of Commons, as well as all the passages leading to it, were thronged by some of the vilest beings that have perhaps ever visited such respectable places. Sallow, cadaverous, gaunt men, dressed in greasy moleskin or rusty black, and wearing wisps of dirty white handkerchiefs round their wizened necks. They had the air of wicked sextons or thievish gravediggers. There was a suspicion of degraded clergymen about them, mingled with a dash of Whitechapel costermonger. Their ghoulish faces were rendered horrible by smirks of self-satisfied cunning, and their eyes squinted with sidelong suspicion, fear, and distrust. So before we go any further, we need to have a look at how it was actually done, you know, the technical information. You needed three crucial pieces of equipment, a wooden shovel, because the noise of soil on wood was a lot quieter than the noise of soil on metal, the dark lantern, he's got one here, and it threw its light downwards, so you're at much less risk of attracting attention. And two large metal hooks attached to lengths of rope. Now, a hole was dug down to the head of the grave only, to the lid, where you reach the head of the coffin. And then when you've reached that, you lean down into the hole, you insert the hooks under the lid, and the weight of the earth is still resting along the body of the coffin, acting as a counterweight. So when the ropes are pulled, the lid of the coffin snaps across here, and the head and the shoulders are revealed. A rope was then attached around the shoulders of the corpse, and the corpse was fished up out of the grave. And fishing is exactly the word that Dickens's fictional body snatcher Jerry Cruncher uses to describe his work in A Tale of Two Cities. However, a lot more work was involved if you were working on a pauper grave or any kind of mass grave. Pauper graves usually held around 20 corpses, oldest burials obviously at the bottom, newer ones on top. And if, as was not uncommon, five or six paupers had been buried on the same day, the resurrectionists could have a really large haul. One of the top London resurrectionists in the first decade of the 19th century claimed that he once cleared out two separate mass graves in an hour and a half, and another one said that his fastest speed had been achieved when he'd exhumed one body in 15 minutes. But this had only been possible, he said, because it had been very loose soil and a very very loose gravelly soil and a shallow grave. But it is worth pointing out how fantastically strong these men were. Surgeon Bransby Cooper was told by one of the top resurrectionists of the 1810s that while he'd had several heavy manual, heavy labouring jobs, nothing had come close to body snatching for the sheer physical endurance. Some of them were lifting 6 or 7 bodies up a night out of the grave and over the high walls of the graveyard. Many of them had actually also completely coincidentally been prize-fighting boxers. Bill Harnett was among the first wave of elite London resurrectionists. He disturbed the dead between 1800 to 1815. He'd been a much admired prize fighter in his day. And he once beat a rival resurrectionist called Ben Crouch in a prize fight at Wimbledon. And Crouch had fought really dirty, but he'd still managed to lose. And it was said that this had been the starting point of an infamous feud between the two men. It went on to last years. Bill Harnett was described as the most cheerful and good-natured of the resurrectionists, and with an Irish accent, which is really weird because he wasn't actually Irish. After a long and successful career in resurrection, he took to gin, though, and he died very slowly of consumption. And it's said, I mean, it would be said, this, wouldn't it? But in his last days, he'd expressed a terrible horror that he himself might end up being dissected. Can't vouch for that one. Ben Crouch saved enough money, largely, it has to be said, for his huge success in selling teeth, corpses' teeth to dentists to make falsies, to be able to open a hotel in Margate, which was initially successful, but once talk got around the town how he'd come by his money, he was shunned and boycotted. As a result, Crouch turned to drink and quickly became a pauper. And he was found one dead afternoon sitting upright at a table at his favourite pub on Tower Hill. William Millard was another boxer turned resurrectionist. With his earnings from resurrection, Millard was able to save up and open a small restaurant. But when locals discovered, you know, the source of his money, he was boycotted, so he had to go back to the day job. Now, the resurrection community were keen to keep the trade as exclusive as possible, with no newcomers coming in and bringing down prices, as well as being indiscreet and thereby rousing public anger. You had to be discreet, otherwise you'd be drawing real heat on the whole community. So each little group guarded its secrets, the contacts that it had with hospitals, the rates of pay per body or body part, which coachmen could be trusted to convey bodies with no questions asked, and which surgeons were likely to be the softest touch during bargaining sessions. They were keen to maintain their monopoly of the trade, and they wanted no part-timers or casual workers infiltrating the business, de-skilling it, de-professionalising it. And as we'll see later on, they were absolutely right about this, and newcomers would be the very thing that did spoil the trade. One of the body snatchers interviewed by the Select Committee of 1828 was very scornful about the part-timers. They get a body or two and they call themselves resurrectionists. He was really bitter and he said he believed them to be no more than petty common thieves who were spoiling it for the much more committed professionals. So why did people do such a terrible job? It's really physically demanding. Purely speculative, and it leads you to be the most hated member of your community. Well, the answer, as you would probably guess, is that the financial rewards could be huge. Just going to throw some statistics at you to try to put that in some kind of context. A highly skilled working man in regular employment could bring home 30 shillings a week. A national survey of 1841 came up with a figure of 15 shillings a week for the averagely skilled man. In 1829, when the Metropolitan Police was created, the starting weekly wage for constables was 21 shillings. At the other end of the scale in 1829, a skilled weaver working in the badly hit silk industry of the East End could earn as little as 5 shillings a week, working a 12-hour day, 6 days a week. And some economic historians have suggested that the drop in real pay right across the country could have been as much as 40% between the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 and the death of George IV in 1830. A disinterred body, by contrast, could bring in between 4 and 12 guineas, and there were 21 shillings to a guinea. So by a very crude calculation, the least valuable corpse was worth 4 times the weekly wage of a Metropolitan Police officer. Now, prices depended on a corpse's freshness and whether it was likely to exhibit any interesting medical conditions. Male corpses were more valuable than female because they offered a much greater scope for the study of musculature. And a fresh, well-developed limb could be worth more than a whole body that was on the verge of putrefaction. Some snatchers and surgeons were even said to make their bargains by inch of usable flesh. Hair for wig manufacture and teeth for dentures, as I've mentioned, were highly profitable sidelines. Some of you who've already been to the exhibition may have spotted the most amazing item, the Diary of a Resurrectionist. It was written by Joshua Naples, who was one of a gang who operated in the late 18th century up to around 1815. And his diary is the only known example of something written by a resurrectionist rather than about them. From the diary, we learn that in one six-day period in 1811, Naples's gang earned £104 by raising 25 bodies. Now, that had to be divided up between the four members of the gang. Plus, there's lots and lots of hush money to pay out to your informants and people that you want to look the other way. But nevertheless, that's a colossal sum for these days. As I've mentioned, unusual illnesses or deformities sent the price of a body soaring. In the autumn of 1827, a female inmate of an insane asylum was known to be dying. William Davis, a member of one of the most successful of the resurrection groups, called the Spitalfields Gang, he was offered 20 guineas by surgeons who were keen to anatomise her brain, still thinking that, you know, obviously if you dig into the matter, you'll find out why she had gone mad in the first place. Davis was in the act of digging the girl up in a private burial ground called Wigginton's in Golden Lane when he was arrested by a parish watchman who'd received a tip-off, just as Davis himself had received a tip-off about the date and place of the funeral. There were seven burial grounds in the Golden Lane area, and Wigginton's was one of the largest. Annoyingly, on this map, these private places did change hands quite a lot, so they don't always go under the same moniker. But here it is. This is actually Wigginton's. I don't know if you can read there, but it's actually describing itself as Thomas's. That it was another owner when this map was actually drawn. We've got Golden Lane. We've got City Road going up and down here. Finsbury Circus. Tube and the horrible great roundabout at Old Street will be here soon, before too long. Wigginton's, come Thomas's, was on the site of the Jacobean Theatre, The Fortune, and it had become a graveyard in the 17th century, and in the early 19th century became a private concern. Now, Wigginton's were a firm of undertakers in Old Street, and I might be slandering Mr. Wigginton, but it would be perfectly well within the way things worked in those days, if he had in fact been the source of William Davis's information about the insane girl's corpse. Certain London undertakers, sextons, grave diggers, and night watchmen were happy to pass on any rumour they'd ever heard about an illness, an impending death, or an actual death. Just for those of you who know the area, just the seven are. We've obviously got Bunhill Fields, which is still there, absolutely glorious park. That's all still in place. Up here, the St. Luke's Insane Asylum had a very large burial ground just behind it there. Here's St. Luke's Parish Church with its own parish burial ground. Just off the map over here in what is today Seaward Street, the church had a little overspill graveyard, which is now a sort of tiny park. The Quaker burial ground was an overspill for Bunhill Fields. That's now a school playground. Wigginton's, Thomas's, we know about. And then just down here, off Brackley Street, is on the site of it now, a tiny little ground called Cupid's Court Graveyard. That's under building now. So can it be any wonder that the resurrectionists are the most hated, violently hated people? Many relatives terrified. You've just lost someone you care about, and now you have to worry about their actual physical remains being carted off for money. Many relatives devised various tricks so they could find out if a grave had been disturbed by the resurrectionists. They could leave a very small object, such as a pebble or a twig or a shell or a flower, on top of a new grave. And the most talented body snatcher was the one with the sort of most practiced eye, who observed exactly how the ground lay before he started work, and he could put it all back again in the right order when he'd finished. The most vulnerable graveyards were the very small private grounds, which offered cut-price burials to the very poor. These were very often, though, not the final resting places, and in fact, poor dead Londoners were often caught up in as much hustle and bustle as they were when they were dead and when they lived. In life, many of them had been vagrants, constantly being moved on, and in death, a lot of them didn't get a chance to stay still for very long either. Many people were being very keen that they should make themselves useful during their afterlife. The vast majority of corpses used for dissection practice were those of the poor, because in general, the wealthy were better able to be placed into the secure vaults or mausolea, maybe a family vaults, or to find themselves in properly protected churches, or you could even buy patent coffins designed, so the advertising said, specifically to Fox resurrectionists. The most expensive plots in a graveyard were those that were most highly visible from the street or a watch house, and so they were less appealing for the body snatcher hoping to work in the dark out of view. We get a view of the going rates for London burials from Mr. Thomas Tagg, who owned the Globe Fields, very small private concern, halfway up Globe Road in Bethnal Green. It had formerly been a Wesleyan burial ground, and then it was bought up and went private. Today it's a rather mournful but intriguing little park and garden. Tagg revealed that his middle-class customers secured themselves a plot at the most prominent part of the ground within sight of his own home for one guinea, 21 shillings, for an adult, half a guinea for a child. The middle part of the ground, slightly less desirable, would cost you 14 shillings, seven for a child, while at the edges of the yard, out of sight of any buildings, the poor could be interred for as little as 10 shillings, five for a child. Tagg made a big selling point of his ground's high walls, those aren't those, obviously, suggesting that these offered superior protection from the resurrection men. But in fact, it was Mr. Tagg and his staff that were doing a great deal of the resurrecting in order to make maximum profit from his land. Tagg was in the habit of digging up corpses, chopping up the coffins to sell on as firewood. Coffin fittings went for scrap metal. Then he would dismember the corpses and throw them into a very deep pit at the corner of the graveyard. Even some of the bones got sold on for various trades. He was a real sort of one-man recycler. And in this way, he could also resell the best burial plots. And unfortunately for Mr. Tagg, his graveyard was visible from the railway line that began to rumble, and it still rumbles, overhead in 1840. And a traveller spotted from his carriage window, as the train crossed the viaduct, piles of bodies and limbs being hurled into the deep pits, and he alerted the police, who investigated. This lovely photo, by the way, is available to see online. Ken Russell, not that one, another Ken Russell, has taken some fantastic photos of the East End, and his site is the Bethnal Green Photo Archive, and it's well worth a look. So among Thomas Tagg's other cheapskate measures, his sexton wasn't a sexton, he was a cobbler who'd pull on a surplus to take a quick funeral with a few hastily patched together phrases from the Church of England funeral service. And this also went on at the Hoole and Martin private ground in New Kent Road, where the person taking the service was also a cobbler in disguise. And at a private ground owned by an undertaker called Butler, just south of London Bridge, Mr. Butler was actually hollowing out and making use of his neighbour's cellars, passing these off as highly desirable and secure burial vaults. Butler also put up a wooden sign saying Minister's House, clearly attempting to pass it off as a consecrated ground when it was no such thing. And this sort of racket went on throughout London's small private burial grounds. And if it actually hadn't been for the resurrectionists and for greedy graveyard owners, the crisis of the overcrowded burial grounds would have arrived a lot sooner than it did. And we all know about Bleak House and the picture there of the graveyard. But in fact, Dickens is being a little bit, you know, after the event, because it was 1842 when Parliament began seriously to discuss the matter and to speed up the move towards large out-of-town cemeteries. The select committee that was convened that year to explore the urban graveyard problems heard some absolutely astonishing figures. Thomas Tagg himself came to the committee and he told them that in his small three quarters of an acre ground, he had 9,500 buried bodies, 15 feet deep, eight to a grave. Then he also went on to say that he still had half an acre empty, and the committee asked him to explain how this could be physically possible, and he just couldn't answer them. By around 1825, public feeling was becoming more and more frequently roused by the sheer volume of bodies being snatched and ferried around town. And in 1829, further pressure was piled onto the resurrection community with the reform of London's policing and the creation of the Metropolitan Police. Previously, policing had been haphazard, to say the least, and while this anonymous cartoon probably goes a little bit too far, there is some justification for the cynicism that was behind it. The pre-Metropolitan Police parish constables, Charlies as they were known, did tend to be elderly men, poorly paid, who preferred to keep to the warmth of their fixed point sentry boxes. And these Regency bucks are having a drunken jape, removing a Charlie as he dozes from the city streets out into the countryside. So before the formation of the Metropolitan Force on the 1st of September 1829, London was policed by a sort of really ramshackle medley consisting of the Charlies, the Bow Street Night Patrol, the Bow Street Day Patrol, the Horse Patrol, the River Police and the Bow Street Runners. Certain new officers in the Metropolitan Force would show really quite a lot of new diligence in cracking down on the resurrectionists. London's new police weren't detectives, and they had in fact been formed to prevent crime happening in the first place. They were a preventive police force. And not until 1842, with the formation of the detective branch, was that aspect of policing seriously, professionally addressed. However, as we'll see in a moment, one London police officer made an important early foray into the world of detection. The clearing up of mysteries that did take place in the early 1830s was still the work of the Bow Street Runners, the small plainclothes force that had been set up by Henry Fielding in the 18th century, and which worked alongside the new police until they were disbanded in August 1839. Now, the runners relied heavily on informants to solve crimes, and anyone who contributed to a conviction received a sum from the court in recognition of their evidence. Many people idolised the runners, but even as early as 1816, six of them had been transported after being found guilty of setting up robberies and then going on to claim the proceeds of the crime by acting as private prosecutors for those robberies. The runners were among the most sceptical about the new police's ability to bring wrongdoers to justice. And Robert Peel's new force faced enormous opposition and contempt for Peel's bloody gang, Peel's private army, the Blue Devils, the plague of blue locusts. It permeated the whole of London society, and lots of London justices of the peace did all they could to make the new police's everyday working life really quite difficult. We find this really odd today, but so much hostility amongst those actually in authority. But in addition to the new police, those parishes who could afford to do so decided to act on their own and tighten up their graveyard security. Some of them began posting armed guards, so they'll have blunderbusses and other types of firearms. Less costly and less dangerous protective measures were such things as tripwire, spring guns. Graveyard walls were starting to be built higher and higher, and you do see that in some very old walls that they've actually had, you know, some extra brickwork put on with broken glass cemented in and iron spikes embedded into the top. One experienced snatcher claimed that he'd been fired on five separate occasions, though each time he'd managed to escape injury. While Patrick Murphy claimed that while he was scaling the graveyard wall of St Matthew's Bethnal Green, that he was fired on by the watchman and it had shattered a brick just a couple of inches away from him, and he'd received buckshot injuries on that occasion. So increasingly, the act of nighttime resurrection was becoming less and less palatable, and certain London resurrectionists began to diversify their working methods. One of the most grotesque was to discover if there was a friendless pauper dying in a workhouse infirmary. And this is where the women folk of Resurrection Men could come in very handy. They would pose as a friend or a relative of the very sick pauper. They'd establish a presence at the bedside so that when death occurred, they could simply go along to the workhouse authorities and ask them if they could remove the body themselves in order to give them a private funeral. Most workhouse masters, not surprisingly, were only too keen to be saved the cost and bother of a pauper funeral and readily agreed. There was also a rise in the breaking and entering of undertakers' premises and parish mortuaries. And sometimes bodies would just simply be stolen from a dwelling house, just like any other household object could be nicked. Thomas Head used a crowbar to break into the home of one Mrs. Sullivan, a widow living in Red Lion Court, just off Hackney Road, knowing that she was out and that her dead teenage son was lying in wake on her kitchen table. He died after suffering a long illness, which presumably most of the neighbourhood knew about. Neighbours did notice Head carrying a large and offensive-smelling basket through their court, but just astonishingly, nobody said, oi, you know, nobody stopped him. I've got a picture here of Thomas Head, but he's going under his alias, Thomas Williams, in the dock at Bow Street Police Court. He's in the middle there, and along with James May and John Bishop. Bishop, by 1830, was one of London's most prolific resurrectionists, and his response to the graveyard clampdown had been to get tip-offs of lodgings where a death had occurred or was about to occur, take rooms there posing as a journeyman carpenter carrying a very large basket, later absconding with the body. He was born in Highgate in 1797, and by 1830 had lifted or stolen, again, another one of those fantastically inaccurate mid-19th century figures, between 500 and 1,000 corpses. He'd been the son of a successful small businessman, and he'd inherited his father's going concern, a carting business in Highgate, upon his father's death. But somewhere along the line, Bishop discovered that body snatching was both more exciting and potentially more lucrative than running his own errand cart firm, and he changed profession circa 1818. He shocked Highgate by marrying his own stepmother on the death of his father. And despite the fact that he must have been earning good money from that amount of body snatching, by the summer of 1830, Bishop, his wife comes stepmother, and their four children moved to one of the most insalubrious areas of Bethnal Green. Here it is, Nova Scotia Gardens. It lay just to the north of what is now Columbia Road, approximately, for those of you who know the area, where the Tower Block Civil House now stands. And it was a really odd collection of quaint, tiny cottages that may have started. They're very mysterious. They may have started life as some kind of summer house for the Huguenot weavers living further south. We've got these huge back gardens, which did have the remnants of mulberry trees in, which the silk weavers would have used. And it's tempting to think that these were actually tenter grounds used to stretch and dry silk. A year later, in the summer of 1831, Thomas Head, that's the chap who stole the teenage boy, he moved in next door to the Bishop's, having just been released from Millbank Penitentiary after serving a sentence for petty theft. With John Bishop down on his luck, getting older, turning increasingly to drink, and just finding his whole rigmarole of obtaining fresh flesh for the surgeons more and more irksome, Thomas Head made John Bishop a very startling suggestion. So we're now just going to briefly nip back over to the other side of town to meet our third late period resurrection man. James May was 30 years old, there over on the left. He was as good-looking and friendly a resurrectionist as you could ever wish to meet. Like Bishop, he'd had a comparatively good start in life He was the illegitimate son of a barrister who paid for him to be educated, and he was said to have this really rather lovely copper plate handwriting. May was found a job as a legal clerk by his dad, found this boring, asked if he could be apprenticed to a butcher instead. Got himself apprenticed to a butcher, found it boring. The one job that he didn't find dull was resurrection, and by the late 1820s, he was one of the most prolific in London. One of his most successful periods occurred when he took lodgings in Clements Lane, which is still there. It's just east of Kingsway, south of Lincoln's Inn Fields. And May's rooms overlooked one of London's most notorious graveyards, the Overspill burial ground of St Clement Danes Church. And it was also used as the burial ground of St Clement's Workhouse, which was in Portugal Street. And from his window, May would look out and keep a very sharp eye for fresh interments. Now, one November lunchtime in 1831, James May went to his one of his favourite boozers, the Fortune of War in Giltspur Street, which is the northern continuation of Old Bailey. The pub was also very handily situated across the road from St Bartholomew's Hospital, and this was the largest resurrection pub north of the river. And in the olden days, not in May and Bishop's time, but in the olden days, the patrons have felt so safe that they'd even brought their bodies along with them, stashed them under the benches, complete with a ticket of ownership, while they went off to strike a bargain with the surgeons, not having to carry the produce with them. James May was drinking at the Fortune of War when John Bishop approached him, asked him to step outside. And although they'd worked for 12 years in the same highly specialised job in the same city, May and Bishop, it seems, didn't know each other particularly well. Both men stayed largely aloof from the bigger gangs, preferring to work only ever with one other snatcher at a time. Bishop, standing directly opposite St Bartholomew's, asked May if he'd had much luck offloading corpses recently and whether he was earning good money for his deliveries. Bishop explained that back at his home in Nova Scotia Gardens, he had a corpse of an adolescent boy in a trunk. Would May be interested in helping to sell the body in return for a share of the sale price, plus a set of fine, unchipped, very white teeth? May was intrigued, and together with Bishop and Thomas Head, who was also drinking at the Fortune of War, they took a hackney cab out to Bethnal Green. Bishop and Head led May into a tiny wash house at the rear of the cottage, untied the trunk and revealed a young lad of around 14 years of age. May had a bradawl in his pocket, punched out both the upper and lower sets of teeth, pocketed them, and then assisted in sacking up the boy and carrying the package out to the hackney cab that they'd kept waiting. All the neighbours saw this happening, but were too terrified to intervene or even say anything. And over the course of the next 36 hours, Bishop, Head and May had little luck trying to offload the item. One of the perils of body snatching was that it was speculative work, and from time to time, what you would experience is oversupply to the hospital and the smaller private medical schools. They tried the dissecting rooms of Guy's, St Thomas's, Granger's Webb Street Private Anatomy Academy in Southwark, Joseph Carpew's private school in Soho, Edward Tewson's school in Little Windmill Street, just off Tottenham Court Road, and every single one of them said that they currently had enough to be going on with. Guy's at least offered to give the corpse a bed for the night in one of its storerooms, but the longer Bishop failed to make a sale, the less fresh and therefore less valuable his dead teenager was becoming. And then one of the three men had a brainwave. The brand new King's College had an anatomy department. What about checking with them for supply? So they took a foot ferry across the Thames from Guy's to the imposing water gate of the new college over there, obviously before the embankment. Walked past a bricklayer who was still finishing off the anatomy department building, and they asked to see the porter, and they made a sale. 2 hours later, they returned with the body in a hamper and tipped it onto the floor, and the porter immediately spotted all was not right. The boy's forearm was sort of really strangely clenched into a fist and raised above his head. There were deep black finger marks on one of the forearms. Strange contusion on one of his temples and another one on the back of his neck. And it was clear to the porter that the body had never been below ground, hadn't even gone through the laying out process before a funeral. The porter asked the cause of death, and John Bishop replied, "It's quite indifferent what he died of. There he is, stiff enough." As the porter kept the body snatchers chatting, the Metropolitan Police Covent Garden Division, Division F, were called. The men were arrested and charged at Bow Street with murder. And throughout the course of the month-long police investigation, there was little doubt about the fact that, inspired by Burke and Hare in Edinburgh 3 years before, Bishop and Head had started to murder people in order to supply extra fresh flesh to the doctors. But the investigation and the subsequent Old Bailey trial of Bishop, Head and James May faced two significant problems. For one thing, James May had had nothing to do with the killings and was well alibied for the night in question. But disliking May's general cockiness and this sense of superiority, the authorities nevertheless pressed ahead with a very, very leaky prosecution case against May. The police case had been conducted by F Division's Superintendent Joseph Sadler Thomas, who, as a very zealous, very energetic new police officer, was disliked by the Bow Street runners, who had even gone so far as to mob him in the street and to mount a physical assault upon him. His wife and children were also threatened by members of the runners who felt that his radical approach to policing in some way was threatening them. And this was Superintendent Thomas's first murder case, and it reveals the fumbling beginnings of a methodical analysis of a crime scene, possible weapons, the checking of alibis, and the testing of eyewitness evidence. All of these things seem blindingly obvious to us today, but in 1831, detection was a very, very new phenomenon, and procedures that we think are just, you know, blindingly clear, they were relatively untested. So in this way, Joseph Sadler Thomas was a model of a new type of policeman. He wasn't content to pay blood money, operate a network of spies, or mingle with criminals, but attempting instead to see what a crime scene could tell him, whether objects could talk. Despite Joseph Sadler Thomas's endeavours, though, the corpse delivered to King's College by Bishop Head and May still had no identity, even on the eve of the first of the Old Bailey trial. The national and London newspapers very quickly seized on a rumour that was doing the streets of Covent Garden, that the victim had been an Italian boy. Italian boys were a very common sight on the streets of London in the 1820s. Since the Napoleonic Wars, the north of Italy had been having a terrible time. Really poor harvests were even sort of threatening famine. And there was a highly organised trafficking network whereby Italian peasants sold, or I think the way they described it was they were loaning for cash, their children to gangmasters who then walked them to the capitals of Northern Europe to sing and dance in the city streets, or to exhibit small animals, or to sell plaster figurines of famous figures of the day, as we can see here. I think you've got a Duke of Wellington, a Shakespeare, pagoda for some reason. Quite fun to work out who's who. There's a great deal of money to be made in this way, because Londoners really seem to take these exotic-looking children to their hearts, but wouldn't you guess it, the children were often they were always exploited, and they were often maltreated by their gang masters. Here's an artist's impression of Carlo Ferrari, whom the newspapers and subsequently the judiciary became convinced was the dead boy whom Bishop Head and May had delivered to King's College. And this engraving became very, very popular. Many, many copies were sold during the police investigation and the Old Bailey trial. During the trial, James May became increasingly agitated as the noose tightened around his neck. He cried out to Bishop, "You're a bloody murdering bastard. You should have been topped years ago." Topped meaning hanged. And this gives a small indication that Bishop had perhaps for many years been supplementing his exhumations with the occasional murder. Perhaps, I'm just guessing, that's why May had always kept his distance from him. in those years that they worked in the same small area together. None of these drawings agree with each other. I don't know what the court sketch artists were up to, but there's one view of them in the dock, Head with his alias there. Another view of them down the bottom, and a very, very corpulent looking Italian boy. I don't think it'd have been that. He actually was about 30, so I don't think that's going anywhere. And this one, and in fact, the artist has mislabeled Williams and May. May is actually supposed to be the middle one. Head come Williams is the one on the right. Later, when his appeal was pending, the police put in front of James May a list of all the resurrectionists they knew of or had even ever just heard rumours about. And the list named 50 men. They asked May to put a pen mark against any of the 50 whom he believed to be capable of murder for dissection. When he handed the list back, he'd marked 5 names. Exasperatingly, this list has never come to light and its contents have never found their way into any newspaper reports or any other kind of documentation. So the extent to which body snatchers did turn to murder will have to remain one of London's many mysteries. So I'll come to an end now, and if anybody's got any questions, I'll try to answer them. And if you haven't already caught the show in the gallery, it's absolutely fantastic and really, really well worth a look. Thank you. I think I'm chairing my own questions, so if anybody wants to put their hands up, we've got a roving mic somewhere. The gentleman there, 3 rows from the back on the aisle. Yeah. Only the murder, only the executed murderers. That's what that march of intellect was about, the idea of trying, but they were seen as absolute lunatic fringe, the people who asked them to do that. Jeremy Bentham, whose body is in University College, in one of the corridors, you can all go in and see him. He's completely stuffed, so he never actually did get anatomised. He tried to make an example, you know, I'll go first and then you can all follow me, and people just didn't. So no, donation wasn't happening. The main non-legitimate source, in addition to resurrection, was the, as the exhibition shows, was the handing over of paupers or people who were deemed to be unclaimed by parish or by workhouses and certain hospital wards. Very hard to know the extent to which it went on, but that's one of the reasons the exhibition is so good. It does try to put that into some kind of context. The other thing you would do, you'd have to work on wax. Yeah, in the exhibition, they've got the Joseph Town wax anatomical. And many people said, oh, they're perfectly good enough. And many other people said, no, they're not. It's absolutely not the same as coming at human flesh with a scalpel. It doesn't compare. So that was a big argument within the day. Oh, yes, gentleman down front here. He probably would have covered it all over, nice and turfed, and you know. No, I think we're talking mass poor graves. You'd really only get a stone if you had a little bit of money. I also suspect, but can't prove, that the bodies that this was happening to were of the people who wouldn't really dare ask, or if they dared ask, they wouldn't get much of an answer. I think people were quite clever about who they picked on in terms of this kind of racket. That's my feeling. I don't know if it's available to read online, but all of Thomas Tagg's testimony in front of the Select Committee on Graveyards of 1842, which is where all this comes out, that's a terrific read. And you keep coming up with questions like that. Well, why didn't they don't ask, and he never suggests why? It's just extraordinary. Lady here. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's called a mort safe. And you see them in quite a lot in various sort of particularly rural churchyards. If you had a bit of money, you'd get a wrought iron, really, sort of cage over the top of your grave slab. And the idea was that, you know, they'd have to work so much harder to get that out that it wouldn't be worth their while. They needed to get in quick and get out quick, and anything that could hold up a body snatcher, such as these alleged patent coffins, that was another thing. There was or double coffins. I mean, many people work for double coffins, so they'd have to work that much harder. Mort safe was quite a popular way if you could afford one. Oh, lady there. Yes. Well, some poorer people did that as well at some of the private grounds. Either employ a guard, or if the owner or the person running the private concern allowed them, what they do is this absolutely grotesque thing, which when you're trying to grieve for someone, they'd sit at the graveside night and day on a relay system, family members, until their loved one was no longer going to be of any use to resurrection. That's a horrific thing to have to go through. It's absolutely no wonder that these people were so reviled, really hated. Yeah, but you had all sorts of... But you had to have a graveyard or a sexton or a watchkeeper who was keen to allow you to do that. And as we know, quite a lot of people were in on the network and so would say, oh, no, that's not allowed in consecrated ground, because they'd already lined it up to be lifted for a cut of the money. I think so. Winter better, obviously, than summer. But, yeah, unfortunately, well, it is gruesome and grisly. And as you know, if you've ever been bereaved, it's just that concept is just so awful. Lady here. Yes. Quite rare. Your church had to have a bit of money to go designing and erecting that. And of course, sometimes all the watchtowers were a more sort of comfortable, glamorous place for a corrupt sexton or churchman to sit in and open the gates. We don't know. We can't ever know how effective they were. But not many parishes could really stretch to that. One of the most famous ones is opposite St Bart's. It belongs to St Sepulchre's Church on the corner of Holborn and Giltspur Street. That's a really lovely little building, but heaven knows whether they actually were worth the money. I think they were all up to it. I think they all pretty much had to. If you wanted to be able to attract good students, good paying students, you had to be able to promise them that they get at least one body during their training. So I don't think anyone could be pointed at more than another. Everybody did it. The most well documented, and again, this is a brilliant read, I'm sure it'll be online, Bransby Cooper's autobiography of his uncle, Sir Astley Cooper, the most eminent surgeon of the day. There wasn't anything he wouldn't chop up. He had special deals with the menagerie at the Tower, all sorts of bird keepers and private zoo keepers. The minute even at Billingsgate, if something really unusual sailed in on the ships, they'd alert Sir Astley, he'd buy it and take it apart. You just weren't safe around Sir Astley. But so he's on record. And Hunter, that's a little bit, I don't specialise in that, but Yo-Yo Hunter was absolutely prolific, yes, definitely. They all had to. The question is, whether they... Well, you can't even do it honestly, can you? If you've got to do it something unpleasant, then you've got to do it. That's why they all wanted the passing of the Anatomy Act, to try and make it legit and to stop them having to deal with these dreadful people. Yes, by the general public. The idea is you're the one that's commissioning the crime. There'd be no birking and there'd be no body snatching if you jumped up barbers, didn't want to better yourself. That whole idea of a middle class rising across the 19th century, looked down on by the poor and looked down on by the rich. And so, yes, it was seen as you don't value human flesh as anything remotely spiritual. You just see it as a lump to practice on. So, yes, they faced dreadful, dreadful opposition. Oh, they'd have their sort of windows smashed. Not so much in London. Funnily enough, the London crowd were a little more docile, but Edinburgh, huge centre of obviously medical training, huge. I mean, the burning of Knox, who commissioned Burke and Hare. He didn't commission them to kill. He didn't really know that was happening, but he certainly bought people off him. Burnt in effigy, windows smashed, had to flee to London. Yeah, they were absolutely reviled, and sometimes under their property would be under attack. Yes. There could be, yes. I don't think they'd want you hanging around, but you do get coroner's inquests. I mean, the Italian boy himself, I don't think he gets to go underground for about a week because they wanted, you know, various opinions on what these injuries might mean. But there was no great hurry, and also, obviously, I do think much more than today, our days of refrigeration really do help us a lot in this. But obviously, if you die between October and March, it's going to be less of a worry. If you're dying in a hot July, people are going to really want to do this more quickly. But no, there wasn't any particular... As quick as you civilisedly can, I think, is probably the answer. The back.
I have a microphone. How exciting is that? You touched on it a little bit before, kind of how sensationalist stories like this were covered in the newspaper and how that almost fed into the trial and kind of the judicial opinion around this. How difficult is it to establish kind of the truth of what was going on in this time period and kind of what resources do you use to kind of create an accurate picture?
It was quite hard because obviously, just as today, people wanted to tell the most melodramatic, exotic, exciting story possible. And all you can do is try and employ common sense and see whether the story in itself makes sense, to see whether any of the sources back each other up in any way. It was difficult, and I think all a historian can do when you might be dealing with a shaggy dog aspect of some of the anecdotes is say, well, this newspaper reported this, this one contradicted it by saying that, and just throw it over to the reader. You know, you're all as clever as I am. You can make up your mind whether that seems plausible or reasonable or whether somebody said this for money. The reason I wrote the book in the first place is because I read that John Bishop was the killer of 60 people. And now, as we know, we're very lucky, apart from Harold Shipman, we don't have massive serial killers in this country. I mean, 60 is, you know. And I thought, how can that be true? That, you know, this 19th century mass slaying, and I never heard of it. The reason that figure 60 has still ever come into the books at all is because somebody, a boozy magistrate, misheard somebody saying 6 for 60. This got into the newspapers, and there was an absolute panic. Had John Bishop, you know, processed as many as 60 people? No, he didn't. The answer was 6. And the reason we're able to know that is because this huge fight broke out in the letters pages, and it got quite factional. One section of the Church of England was fighting another about who said what, who was drunk, who can't hear properly. And so that's another way in which you can try to establish something more likely. So, not easy, but I think you just have to be honest with your evidence and say, somebody said this, somebody said that. Suspect it might be somewhere in the middle. That's all you can do after all these years. Well, generally, they just wanted to stay aloof, which was the criticism made of them throughout the 19th century. You know, but where do you stand on this? The body is sacred, so officially, you know, the body is sacred, and you're absolutely not supposed to, stop it going to earth. Officially, they didn't say much at all, but I think generally they wished surgeons would just carry on working on the wax, you know, and wish all this ghastly nonsense would go away. They didn't enter the field anything like as much as you might think they would. And others, you know, maybe of a more evangelical bent, thought, well, it's very important that humankind does progress. We do get cleverer, we get better. Because you have to set it against appalling surgical procedures. You know, you'd do anything in those days not to have to, you know, the knife taken to you, because they didn't really understand sepsis. You know, they didn't understand that, you know, if you leave a wound open, you know, in then you're likely to die slowly of the results. So a lot of people thought, no, we mustn't hold up progress. It's what God would have wanted us to progress in this way. But generally, I don't get any strong sense of them being particularly interested in that subject at all. I've not come across any murder for dissection trials. Same time as Bishop and Williams are on trial. Well, 2 months after was actually a very, very nasty case in Whitechapel, where Eliza Ross is sent to the gallows. And that, I think, is a got-up case, amazingly, between her second husband and her son. I think she was involved in the resurrection trade in some way, but she was accused of murder. And when you read it, you think, I don't think this is right at all. But I've not come across any other murder for dissection, although you do obviously come across lots of misdemeanor trials for body snatching. Suicides, I think they weren't murderers, so they weren't legitimate. Again, some lovely parish mortuary man or undertaker might have thought, oh, well, they're worthless, I'll send them along to the anatomy department. If they did, it would be unofficial and not legit. And Burke and Hare. Well, Burke and Hare is a fantastic story. That's why it's been told over and over again. And you get some brilliant dramatic and film representations. Is it Donald Pleasance played him really creepily in a black and white movie with Melvin Hayes as Daft Jamie, the little idiot boy who they dispatch? It's a brilliant story. It's one of those real-life stories which appears to be imitating a really tightly written three-act play. You've got the two main characters are completely different to each other. They're very differentiated physically and in personality. You've got Daft Jamie, very, very alluring victim. You've got beautiful, beautiful Mary Patterson, who allegedly was so beautiful that they ended up not dissecting her. They kept her in a large bottle of formaldehyde because she was so shapely. You've got Dr. Knox, who really, he didn't know they were murdering, but he didn't ask any questions. So you've got this, and he was absolutely intent on making life better for humanity. And he was a brilliant surgeon, envied and disliked by his colleagues. And the minute this stink erupts, they turn on him. And he's a really tragic, you know, it's real hubris. That's why Burke and Hare is so famous. It's such a cracking story. And that's why these lads have disappeared, because it's a lot messier, you know? They're not as well differentiated. The victims are much more blurred. The action doesn't take place in a sort of nice, tight way. So I think that's the reason. It's just a much messier story, the Italian boy story, than Burke and Hare. I can't possibly say, because if you haven't read the book, I don't want to spoil the plot. Let's just say it didn't end well for anyone. Okay, so if there's any more questions, come and see me out at the foyer.